Are you still settling for mediocre coffee? Why? When it's easier than ever to switch to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, and they even have a rotating seasonal blend for those of you who like to keep things fresh. Oh, and speaking of fresh, Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week or less of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that you always know you're starting with the freshest coffee at its peak flavor. You can take advantage of their autopilot delivery system so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug is offering a special deal to Top 100 listeners. You can get 10% off your next coffee order if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word. The offer doesn't apply to any of the great gear they sell, but you can use it for any size coffee order and you don't have to be a new customer to take advantage of it. So what are you waiting for? The time has come to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I want to watch you brew coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, motion picture lovers, and here's an offering of gratitude for doing the download thing with the Next 103 Project, the ongoing podcast that glimpses at movie classics. If you didn't know this already, we're going to spoil and spoil and spoil and spoil and spoil. I'm the guy who thinks it doesn't matter what you say about people, Ryan Ellis. And here to my right is the dirty cop who loves me, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Touch of Evil. What's the greatest opening tracking shot in movie history? We've got some options here. The Player, Gravity, Snake Eyes. I forgot this one last week in setting this up. Boogie Nights. And then also, these movies are supposed to be either entirely or primarily one-shot movies, although there's some tricks that fake that, but Birdman, Rope, Time Code, Russian Ark, and obviously, Touch of Evil's in this group.
Birdman technically has an edit right at the beginning of the film. There's the shot of a fireball coming down in the sky, kind of like a meteor, then it cuts to the shot that becomes the whole movie, and then it ends again.
Oh, I've forgotten that.
Yeah. I actually looked it up to check because I was curious about that.
We're not picking that one anyway, so it's a moot point.
No, I know. You probably know what I'm going to say. The Player. The Player has the best opening shot in cinema history.
Which refers to this movie when it has its own opening tracking
shot. It's this really self-referential, almost meta tribute to Touch of Evil, among other films. And as you know, I have a soft spot for The Player because it just caught me at that perfect moment of my teenagehood to turn me on to films like that.
I think every shot I mentioned is really impressive and really cool, and the ones that are either supposed to be an entire movie or mostly an entire movie, like Birdman, Rope, Time Code, Russian Ark. I haven't seen Russian Ark, by the way. Pretty cool trick, and I guess Time Code was legit because I don't think Mike Figgis had a budget to have digital cuts in there and edits the way they did in Birdman. Birdman's many shots that make it look like most of the movie is one entirely. Although the ones that aren't an entire movie, like Touch of Evil, The Player, Boogie Nights, they really are wonders. Especially Touch of Evil, because you had no options for digital tricks back then.
I can confirm what you say about Tom Coe, because I just happened to have seen it at a screening where Figgis was there. The director was there, and they talked about how they did it. And it was a new technology to even have a digital camera that could shoot for 2 hours straight. But they had four of them all shooting for 2 hours straight, doing the different scenes. It was a very experimental film. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a good film that I would recommend. But
what
it's
a cool idea.
Cool idea, a great experiment that he kind of pulled off, but I think the challenge may have been too great to both pull it off and make a super watchable film.
I guess I'll go with Touch of Evil, since it's a standard bearer for these kinds of shots.
That is right. That is true. And it was probably a lot harder to do it back then, too, with just the cameras that they had.
One thing I noticed in watching the movie this time is how much the camera is swooping and craning and dipping and diving. It's not just following along. I mean, none of these kinds of shots are easy, but it really is a challenge. And there's the story about how they were doing it so long through the night, because most of the movie was shot at night. And at the end, one of the guys who speaks messed up his lines, and Wells just said, "Mouth it, and we'll put the proper dialogue in later."
If you could give an Oscar to Focus Puller, this would be the movie that deserves it. Man, that must have been a hard job.
Okay, so Touch of Evil was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Universal Pictures gave it an LA premiere on April 23rd, 1958. So, 60 years ago today. We've had several Universal movies lately, by the way, not deliberately. Last Temptation of Christ, Shadow of a Doubt, and now this. I think last year we had a ton of Warner Brothers movies or Fox or something. Maybe it was Fox. Yeah, it was, because we did Alien. I remember commenting, I think it was then, that we had done a lot of Fox movies just coincidentally. Touch of Evil didn't get a lot of attention when it was in American theaters, but it actually did quite well in Europe. Bev, explain this movie for people who don't remember what it's about, or they're listening to us for whatever reason because they haven't even seen the movie and now they're going to be really confused. It's a confusing movie. But give us Skinner.
I was going to say, I just saw the movie and I still am a little confused about the plot, but a bomb is placed in a car in Mexico and explodes, killing its two passengers in Texas, just feet from the Mexican-American border. So who should investigate the murder? Charlton Heston's Miguel Vargas, a stand-up Mexican detective and newlywed who happens to witness the explosion, or Orson Welles' Captain Quinlan, a bloated, arrogant cop who keeps his arrest record high by planting evidence. The rivalry gets heated fast. Vargas threatens to expose Quinlan's crooked police work, and Quinlan frames Vargas' new bride, played by Janet Leigh, for the murder of a Mexican gangster.
Charlton Heston, a Mexican... Fox, you're right. It is pretty silly.
Does he speak a word of Spanish in the whole film, other than, like, amigo?
I read that he wishes he'd put on a Mexican accent, at least. He does do sort of a brown face sort of thing. They do tint his skin a little bit.
Orson Welles was no stranger to tinting, as he had played Othello himself in blackface.
Earlier this decade, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so back to the task at hand. In a nutshell, best friends shoot each other to death. Or, hashtag Mexicans' wives' lives matter. All right, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 96% of critics like this movie, 68 fresh, 3 rotten, and 92% of audiences. Those are great scores, and it's 228th on the Internet Movie Database's top 250. The movie's wordy and complicated, fast-talking, just like me. Dense, requires repeat viewings. Yes, requires, because you're never going to get this movie in one shot. But here you are, somebody who's never seen it before. What'd you think of Touch of Evil?
There's lots to like here, lots to praise, particularly the direction. It feels fresh even now. I love that always moving camera, the long takes, and the really phenomenal lighting. Never feels gimmicky, but the story is a problem. It's not so much that it's hard to follow, which it is. It's also that it has clumsy pacing. It's not that I didn't know why something was happening necessarily. It was that I found I didn't care why something was happening, and that's the problem. I suspect, as you say, this is a film that really needs a second viewing to be appreciated. Kind of like The Big Lebowski, you know, a film that the first time I saw it, I was amused, but it wasn't until I saw it enough times that I could just give up the idea of following the plot to just enjoy it for what it was and enjoy each scene on its own that you come to see that that film is actually a masterpiece. So I'm going to take your word for it and the word of many other critics as well. It gets better with time.
Touch of Evil, Big Lebowski, The Big Sleep, all are movies you have to surrender to the fact that you probably won't figure it out, especially the first or even second time you see it. And Orson Welles deliberately wanted to drive people crazy, Big Sleep-esque in this way. So he succeeded with you, and I'm sure he succeeded with me. I forget the first time I saw this movie, but it was a long time ago, and I know I didn't get it.
I don't value that as a goal, to confuse audiences, because when movies do that, I ultimately find them boring. Because if I don't care about the plot, I don't care what's going to happen, or I can't follow it, then I'm just going to stop paying attention. It means that I'm not going to be paying attention to all of his clever shots and his beautiful, rich character work.
Well, did you stop paying attention?
Yeah. It was funny, when I was reading about the film afterwards, I was like, oh yeah, that scene. I had actually kind of zoned out when this scene or that scene happened.
So you're not a thumb up here.
I'm a thumb up. I do need to see the movie again. Even as I say that, it's not a movie I'm dying to see a second time right now. But you know when, like, you see a shot, a composition, or a scene, and it's just so clever and well executed, and the acting and the lighting, and there's just something fresh about it. You know when you see something like that and it makes you excited? It's just so good. That happened to me so many times watching this movie. I love the scene where the guy tries to throw acid in his face. There's a car chase where the camera all of a sudden gets this really rocky, crazy, handheld vibe happening. I love that stuff. It was so exciting, but the film as a whole, yeah, it left me a little cold. It's funny that by the end, somebody pops in and they're like, hey, that kid confessed to the bombing of the car.
Who really
I was
cares?
Like, oh my God, I forgot that somebody bombed a car.
Right. The camera being in the car was a new touch too. I don't think anyone had ever done that before. It was always process photography. And Charlton Heston and other people drive cars with the camera somewhere attached or maybe behind it. and you can tell they're really driving.
And it was a bumpy road. That's why they would have always used process photography, because they just had no stability with those cameras, and with cars the way they were made, with poor shocks, and the roads in Mexico where they were shooting, I don't know if they were shooting in Mexico, but the roads were pretty bumpy. But in a way, it adds to the drama of it.
So let's go back to the beginning, because that's still the most famous part of this movie, that opening crane shot that people talk about so much. When this movie was first released, there were titles over it, so you couldn't really see what was happening quite as thoroughly. You'd see Charlton Heston, Janet Leigh, and Orson Welles, Touch of Evil, and then all the other credits. But one of the many things that Orson Welles put in his 58-page memo, which has been talked about a lot in this movie's history, he saw the movie once. The reason why he wasn't editing it is because he shot it, and apparently it was actually a pretty good shoot by his standards. He didn't struggle with the studio during the shooting. It was more in post-production. But after he shot it, he went off to do something else, and then they took the movie away from him. He wasn't even there to have the movie taken away, though. So he sees the cut they put together, which I understand was shorter than this cut is, and he hated what they had done with it. But then he wrote this long memo, which I read years ago. I think it's on the DVD, page by page, right? You hit that fast-forward button. I don't remember all what it said now. But his detail, if it's true, and this isn't some apocryphal story, that he actually watched what they did one time and could remember. I don't think he was taking notes during the screening. Do this thing here. I suggest this. This is a good idea. He didn't come across like he was being a bossy dick, but he wanted them to change so many things that were so specific. I have seen certain movies 15 or 20 times. Jaws, for example. Let's say I had notes about that and wanted Spielberg to change it. I know that movie as well as any movie I've ever seen, and I can't remember that kind of specific stuff. I know this is the guy's passion. He adapted the book into a screenplay and he directed it. But man, he was a genius. We just re-released Citizen Kane not long ago. We talked about that when we first did that podcast, and we elaborated on that, and we did some new thoughts. But holy crap, that he could see their cut that he hated and have all these thoughts about what they should do differently.
Well, the whole film comes from your imagination and your hard work. When you spend a whole year working on the pre-production, working on the script, doing casting rehearsals and shooting, I can see how that's going to give you a huge advantage as far as remembering little details. Although there's no question that Orson Welles was an absolute genius.
The whole movie was in his head. They always say the movie's shot in your head before you ever make it, if you're any kind of good director. Mm-hmm. I guess this is a great example of that. So let's go to that opening shot then. Orson Welles apparently was not a Hitchcock fan, but he had a Hitch-type opening where a bomb is set, but it must go off. And in this case, it goes off only a few minutes later. The bombing victim, Lineker, wasn't innocent either. I love that touch. He was cheating with the blonde in his car, clearly. He comes to the nightclub with her, and the bomb's already been put in the trunk, and then when they're exploded, you look at this as if he's some innocent victim, but he wasn't.
The blonde is innocent, I think. I got the impression she was a working girl. He found her at a nightclub with dancing topless ladies, so she's probably a prostitute.
But the guy who was supposed to be killed...
And she tried to warn them! There's this ticking! Right, this ticking in my head! And they're like, don't listen to that dizzy blonde. She doesn't know what she's talking about.
But the guy who's being targeted, I'm not going to say he deserved it, but he wasn't Mr. Nice Guy either. Is the movie stereotyping Mexicans, not this character, but other characters, as rapists who are bringing drugs?
Okay, there's an argument to be made that all the Mexican characters are criminals, but our hero is Mexican. <And he's... laughs> God forbid they cast a Mexican, or at the very least, a Latino actor.
The glory of God guy.
Listen, it was the 50s. But he's the hero, and despite the fact that he doesn't speak Spanish, he is Mexican. He's the clean cop. He's absolutely the squeaky clean good guy in this scenario. And you would argue that Quinlan, the American detective, he would be like the Mexican stereotype of the dirty, crooked cop.
It's a nice touch that the Rebel Wells has the Mexican as the hero and the American dirty cop as the villain. Because you wouldn't have seen that in too many movies back then, and even the years that followed. Maybe into the 70s you might have started seeing that, but not up till 1958.
Maybe it was to contrast the fact that all these other villains were Mexican, so it would have seemed like quite a bit of overkill if they also had a crooked cop.
I like the line that Welles has, all a lawyer cares about is the law, and that's said by a dirty cop. Really eye-opening for him to say something like that.
Also a great line, police work is only easy in a police state. Mm-hmm.
We also, I find this interesting, pick up the story partway through, because Vargas has been dealing with Grandy for a while now. One of the reasons why the movie's confusing is because they don't give you this whole sort of, put the hand on the shoulder, you know what happened when I did the thing last week with Grandy? They do sort of do that kind of thing, but not for the most part. You have to catch up and realize that this investigation by Vargas has been happening for a long time. Quinlan doesn't know Vargas, but a lot of the other characters do, especially Grandy.
And it's confusing because Grandy has nothing to do with the bombing. There's no connection between the two of them. the connection just happens because Quinlan wants to frame Vargas, so he enlists this criminal that Vargas has been trying to destroy.
What would Grandy and Quinlan have done if not for Susie, his wife? She's Vargas's weak spot. Well, her and acid, which almost ends up in his face. What would they have done?
What would they have done?
It's one of those things, Hitchcock said it, there'd be no movie.
She's a great character that, like a lot of female characters, winds up being disappointing. I just say that because she's really smart, she's really brassy.
And she's tough.
She's tough, but in the end, she's still a damsel in distress. Mm. Let's talk about the fact that Orson Welles clearly wanted there to be an explicit rape, maybe not a rape scene, but he really implies that gang of criminals going to rape her. I want to watch. That line right there, if you have any doubt in your mind that that's supposed to be a rape, but then it's as though that scene never happened.
It was supposedly just the sodium pentothal injection, which is supposed to be a drug thing.
But that's not what they were doing to her.
Why does she want to watch that? She wants to watch them do other things.
Yeah. So that's like a really strange choice that the movie makes, and I have to just chalk it up to it was 1958. That if he wanted to make something that was that dark, he just wasn't going to get away with it. So we put this implication in without putting the consequences of that in. Now, we don't ever really see Susie at her full power ever again after that point because she's drugged and she's helpless and she just needs Mike to save her. For all we know, there could be some repercussions later where she admits to him or maybe nobody that they actually gang raped her before they drugged her up and framed her for the murder.
Now, we spoke last week in Shadow of a Doubt about how Uncle Charlie never did touch young Charlie. But the subtext is that he wants to.
Yeah.
And it's a rape thing. It's not just, I'm a criminal and you can't out me. It's that whole sort of thing we talked about in Mulholland Drive. That audition scene that Naomi Watts has, where that's supposed to have been some sexual activity in the past. And that's what seems to be going on in the Shadow of a Doubt subtext. So you got two straight movies. One was 15 years earlier. Yeah, 15 years earlier with Shadow of a Doubt. But both of these films, the last 2 weeks, definitely have subtextual rape situations, although it doesn't actually happen in Shadow of a Doubt.
Well, Shadow of a Doubt, the secret that she has to keep about her uncle's past is a metaphor for sexual abuse in a family, for incest, but it's much more well-drawn in that film. It's baked into it. Rather than this scene, talk about effective directing in the scene where Susan's in the hotel room and they finally break in. The menace in that scene, she is so trapped. Even if she got away, there's nowhere she could go. There's no way she'd get away from these people. It was a truly frightening scene, and I felt for her in that moment. Whatever they wanted to do to her, they were going to do to her.
Janet Leigh was legitimately scared, too.
Oh, really?
That's what I was reading.
Oh, man.
And like I say, she was a tough broad. She was one of those actresses who didn't shrink away from people back then. She was not one of the ones that Hitchcock abused or tried to take advantage of, like he did with T.P. Hedren and some other actresses he'd worked with. I've only ever heard from her that it was great, and maybe because he respected her cojones. And, of course, Hitchcock worked with her 2 years later in Psycho after this film. The hotel manager in this movie, Dennis Weaver, they say that Norma Bates, a hotel manager in the middle of nowhere, motel manager, is based on this guy. But Dennis Weaver, who's really good in Duel, the Spielberg movie about the truck that tries to run down the car, he's not very good in this. He's a little over the top, he's a little silly. Norma Bates is one of the more subtle performances anyone's ever given. Weaver is not at all in this.
Anthony Perkins' performance is one of the greats in cinema. It's so subtle, it's so good. The Nightman, as he keeps calling himself, he doesn't really have a name. It's almost as if he's on the spectrum. His behavior is so strange, and he seems so impossible to reach, whether it's by the criminals or by Vargas. And I never understand whose side he's on or where he fits into all of this. Sometimes he seems to be helping the criminals out, and sometimes he seems to just not want anything to do with anything.
He's a pawn for them. I think maybe he's in on it the whole time, but he certainly is for a big chunk of the movie when she's out in that motel by herself.
They spend way too much screen time on him for it to be that confusing. And again, maybe this is a detail that becomes clearer if you see the film multiple times. But it does pay off in the scene when Vargas is chasing him down, trying to get information. He's definitely overacting. Forget chewing scenery. This guy is tearing it apart. It's way too much. But I do love that scene and the camera's moving so fast and they're running around in the dark and there's these great big barren trees that he's almost trying to climb up to get away from Vargas. It's a really, really well-directed scene that I guess is the reward for putting up with that character in the rest of the film. Because, man, he's a lot.
Janet Leigh just has bad luck checking into motels and black and white movies made by great directors.
So true. Yeah, it's so funny. Speaking of Psycho.
And in the middle of nowhere, too. Get out of there! Susie goes through all what's happening with the Me Too movement now. Peeping, because that's what he's doing early on, the night manager. Got another thing coming. rape, assault, and she's terrorized. She can really relate to people that dealt with Harvey Weinstein and really tens of thousands of men, maybe hundreds of thousands of men who are living in the world right now, let alone in the history of the world.
Even when she's still in the border town and they try to corner her in the office and try to manipulate her by just making her afraid to get to her husband.
That's when she shows how tough she is, right in that scene more than anything else.
She has some great dialogue.
Okay, let's change gears here to something that isn't quite as offensive. Then again, it is offensive because it's setting up a Mexican, but it's not quite as bad as what happens to Janet Leigh. There's the ultra-long take in Sanchez's apartment, where later on, Menzies plants the evidence. And I wonder if the subtext is supposed to be, even in 1958, if Wells was on top of this, that Sanchez might as well be black. Now, we do have the whole aspect of the Mexicans and the Americans in that battle. He doesn't count because he's a Mexican, so to hell with him. But could he be a stand-in for a black character then or now?
Well, Quinlan has the line early in the film where somebody is a witness, and he says, "Speak English, I don't speak Mexican." Mm-hmm. You live on the border. You know it's Spanish. Like, that's an intentionally rude thing to say to them. So, yeah, I agree that it's clear that he obviously has a chip on his shoulder for Mexicans.
And we see Wells' infamous use of ceilings again, especially in that scene, that long take in the apartment with the camera shooting up. Gotta know your lines when you do a scene like that. It's so impressive whenever you see a scene that goes on that long. You see that sometimes now. We've talked about long takes, not just in the opening of movies, but during films. And now, of course, they can take advantage of visual effects and that kind of thing. Children of Men, a lot of other movies Alfonso Cuarón has done, including the opening of Gravity, have been long takes. But then you can fudge it a little bit. You didn't do that here. This one isn't as impressive as the opening shot, but it might be more meaningful because a lot of things are happening. And when you see Heston go into the bathroom to clean up and he knocks that shoebox off the counter, and later on that's where the dynamite was supposed to be, the jig is up right then. Vargas knows.
What a great way to shoot it, that it honestly looks like just an accident, like a throwaway thing that happens, rather than so many movies that would show a close-up of this empty box and give you a musical sting like, pay attention! Dun. And as confusing as this movie is, you figure it out right away. Like, you don't need it. It's so much more natural. So you were talking about, like, actors have to know their lines when they're doing these long, complicated, choreographed takes. Well, Janet Leigh talked about 2 weeks rehearsal that they did for this film, which was at the time pretty unconventional. Not only did they go through the script and carefully plan it all out, and I'm sure if he's a good director, and of course he is, he would have blocked the scenes somewhat according to how the actors would have chosen to naturally move, especially in a tight scene like that. She said that they also, the actors, when they were rehearsing, were rewriting the script as they rehearsed, and it was very collaborative. She was very impressed with how he worked and that he was very persistent, that there was never a bland moment, that everything had to be interesting and amped up, and she just loved it. She said, "He made you feel you were involved in a wonderful event that was happening right before your eyes." Of course, she's not in the scene we're talking about.
She was busy being assaulted somewhere else. But as far as that scene goes, the long take in the apartment, we learn later on that Menzies planted the dynamite, and we learn also that Vargas' investigation has discovered that Quinlan and Menzies have framed a lot of people. And of course, in their last scene together, it's no one who's not already guilty. It's the OJ defense. You already got the guy guilty, so let's make sure he's really guilty and then mess up the case in the case of the OJ trial.
There's no archetypal villain that I personally hate more than the crooked cop who is trying to circumvent justice. He has these gut feelings. In a way, the movie's implying he's right. Because at the end they say, oh, he confessed. Now, meanwhile, over here in 2018, we're all keenly aware that interrogation processes can lead to false confessions all the time. If you have these crooked cops that are probably just going to torture him until he says anything they want him to say, there's no reason to trust a confession if you can't trust the evidence that they're providing anyway. Movies with crooked cops make me so mad. There's nobody I hate more than someone who would overstep justice and potentially ruin an innocent person's life.
Quinlan wants to quit for letting Vargas even ask about his possible dirty deeds. He's such a touchy criminal cop. You can't even ask me these things. I'll throw my badge away, my badge of evil. And of course, that was the name of the book that this movie's based on, Badge of Evil.
It was apparently not a very good book, and it was something of a slush pile of a script. There were legends about how Orson Welles got attached to the project. One is that Charlton Heston, having found out that Orson Welles had been cast in a part, only meant to work as an actor, insisted that he would only do the film if Orson Welles directed. Another legend says that Welles had asked B-film producer Albert Zugsmith to give him the worst script he had, just to prove that he could make a great film out of a bad script.
There's also a legend, and it's an Ed Wood, the movie that Tim Burton did, great movie that nobody saw, although Martin Landau won an Oscar for it. But anyway, in that, Vincent D'Onofrio plays Orson Welles meeting up with Ed Wood, and he's complaining, Welles is, that he's been saddled with Charlton Heston as a Mexican. But as you just said, Heston was on the project first. He was a huge star. Welles' star was waning. And Heston was the one, and he's even on the making of on the DVD. I've heard him say this many times. I've watched the making of a few times, where he says, oh, he's a pretty good director. As if to say, let's use him this way. I'm sure Heston wasn't quite that nice about it. He was a big player and could have said, he directs or I'm out of here. But it wasn't the way they said it in Ed Wood. It was more a matter of the director was not an employee of Heston, but Heston got him on the project effectively, certainly as the director, not just as an actor. I don't know who else would have directed this as well. A lot of people could have. Sure, you could name 20 names, but Welles was one of the greats. And he's playing an alcoholic who falls off the wagon, but his life is already so beyond messed up. He tells a story about the dead wife. You do feel for him, and that's one thing you said, that dirty cops bother you in movies. I think you mean as a compliment, right? That the people in the movies bother you, not the device of using it.
Oh, no. It just gets me, like, really fired up, and sometimes in a great way. Quinlan is a great example. Like you said, the performance, the writing is so exceptional because he really believes he's doing the right thing.
And he wasn't this fat yet. Welles wasn't. He was wearing a fat suit and chunky face makeup.
This is so interesting.
He got to be about that big as we got into the 70s and 80s, but at this point he was still a relatively normal-sized person.
He wanted to portray somebody who had spent his whole adult life in excess, and there's so much self-hatred in this character. He hates himself, he doesn't take care of himself. As he says, you know, he gave up drinking, but then he replaced it with candy bars.
And his wife is dead, so he has nothing else in life but the job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did they think, whether it be Welles or the book or the studios or just people in general, in 1958, that reefer has the same effect as heroin? I guess later on they say it's supposed to be the sodium pentothal, but it's also implied that Susie's so messed up from drugs, like, but not heroin. Reefer. Pot.
I thought the whole reefer madness thing was in the 30s. In the 50s, did they still think marijuana made you act this crazy?
Well, this incapacitated as well.
Yeah, it just makes you eat a bunch of Doritos and watch Portlandia on Netflix all day.
Heroin would do that, but not pot.
Well, heroin doesn't even make you act up that much. Maybe cocaine does, maybe bath salts do.
Trainspotting lied to me?
Well, in Trainspotting, they did heroin and they just fell asleep, right?
Well, that's what she is for a lot of the film. She's knocked out.
Okay, but they're implying throughout the film that these drug addicts, you know, they're in the hotel and they're just getting high and going crazy. What would actually happen is that they would get high and take a long nap. It's not an accurate portrayal of what drugs do to you, is my point. Heroin makes you do some crazy things, I'm sure, but I don't think that strangling a drug dealer is one of them.
That's a pretty grisly moment, too, when he's hanging over the bed frame and she wakes up to see that face, the tongue, as I recall, hanging out of his mouth.
How did they make his eyes bug out like that, too? Freaky shot right there.
Akeem Tamarov is Grandy. He worked for 40 years, did Top Copy about 6 or 8 years later, and he also worked with Welles quite often. But he was pretty good in this film as the other bad guy. Of course, Quinlan is the main bad guy. The final confrontation between all the main characters, not so much Susie and Grandy's already been killed, but Vargas and Menzies and Quinlan, takes place amongst oil pumps, and it's even commented on by, I think, Quinlan, the larger scale corruption. What's really going on? Mexicans, Americans, none of you matter. Big business is going to screw over everybody, whether it be dirty cops or Mexican criminals who are bringing drugs and rape. Nah, it's people like, and let's say it right now, people like Donald Trump that are messing up the world way more than people planting bombs in somebody's trunk, or a good cop, or a bad cop, or a drug addict, or a weird, creepy hotel manager.
And they show an area that's filled with filth. It's a river that's filled with garbage.
Welles directs himself, I like this, into a sad and messy death, just backflopping into that dirty water.
That man had no ego when it came to his performances, which is funny because he's so interested in characters whose main fatal flaw is their ego. You have Kane, you have Quinlan, and you have all the Shakespearean heroes that he played. Well, heroes is a strong word. Certainly wouldn't call Macbeth a hero, but he liked to play characters whose fatal flaw was hubris. But then he also was putting on a fat suit, walking with a cane, and dying face first in the muck.
And you see him in his 25-year-old days in Citizen Kane. He looks good in the movie early on in Citizen Kane, but through most of it he doesn't because he's supposed to be an older guy. He was a matinee idol, though, and you see him in shots where he's not wearing makeup and fat suits in Citizen Kane.
He was a tall drink of water in his youth.
So in that climax, Menzies betrays Quinlan, his best friend, also to save his friend from further bad deeds. Maybe a little bit of vengeance because they shoot each other dead, like I said in the nutshell. And as you said also, Quinlan's right about Sanchez because they did frame him for a murder he did commit. And that is a throwaway moment, but what a nice touch too. It's not that he's innocent, it's that he is guilty.
But the real crime that Quinlan has committed is murder. Like, he has personally murdered a man in a great scene where you see he's not straight up evil. He's doing it on some level to protect himself. And when he is actually committing the act to a person that anybody could agree was a dirtbag, the world is not going to miss Uncle Grandy. But Quinlan struggles with that murder. He is not comfortable with what he has done. Because there is a good man under all of that pain and under all of those years of corruption and the original trauma of losing his wife. There is a good man that could have probably been a good cop. But in that moment, he crosses the line. And that's why he deserves to die. And that's why his partner kills him.
And leaves his cane behind as well. Kind of like Biff in Back to the Future Part 2, where the cane is a piece of evidence. Otherwise, the characters wouldn't know necessarily who did it. Oh, well, maybe in this movie, they would have figured it out. But in Back to the Future 2, they probably wouldn't know at all. Well, let's talk some more about maybe the most famous thing about this film, other than the opening shot, maybe even including the opening shot, and the great actors. And that would be the studio interfering in how it was made. Harvey Weinstein-esque changes were made. We talked about how he wasn't on the film anymore. A lot of people had a shot at cutting this movie. The two editors that are credited are Aaron Stell, who cut To Kill a Mockingbird, which we covered in the Top Runner Project a long time ago, and Virgil Vogel. This was his last editing job. He went on to direct. So many other people took a crack at editing this back then, but then Walter Murch, one of the guys that you revere, and I do too, he's a great editor, he worked on the 1998 re-edit, which effectively is a director's cut because he went by that memo in trying to make the movie be what Wells wanted it to be. And even though this movie is so revered now and it's on all kinds of lists of greatest films and all that, it was treated like a B-movie. Heston called it that in the Top 100 Thrills special. And I remember hearing that thinking, no, it's not. I was a little bit offended. But no, a lot of movies that are thought of as great were B-movies in their origin, became A-movies in your mind maybe later on. So the top billed star, Charlton Heston, old John Carter is his real name. He was between Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments. Of course, Ten Commandments came first and then Ben-Hur came after. Epic, gigantic moneymaker, two of the biggest hits of all time. And of course, we also covered Planet of the Apes, where he's done some of his best overacting of all time. He's also known for the NRA stuff. He seems like a nice enough guy, and he wasn't the best actor of all time, but the 50s, he was certainly becoming the king of Hollywood because he'd also been in the Best Picture winner, The Greatest Show on Earth, in 1952, when he was still pretty new to Hollywood. Charlton Heston, it's a Mexican. Knee slapping.
I guess it's more convincing than Charlton Heston as an Arab in the Ten Commandments. He should be pretty Semitic in that film.
John Wayne playing Genghis Khan. It's a little absurd as
Whoa,
well.
Whoa, that's definitely worse.
I think that was also in the 50s. Well, all these kinds of movies like Ten Commandments and Genghis Khan, those kinds of movies that were biblical or that were set over in Asia and Africa, I don't think ever starred people who actually are from that area. We talked about that not too long ago, that Christian Bale and Joel Edgerton had to be cast, according to Ridley Scott, in... I'm going to get the name around this
Gods
movie wrong
of
again.
Egypt? Or...
No, we had that wrong before.
Oh, damn it.
Exodus, Gods and Kings. It had to be two white guys, and Christian Bale, of course, is a big name.
No, according to him, it just had to be two movie stars, and I guess they just happen to be white.
We've said a lot about Janet Leigh. She also had a broken arm in this movie, and when they had to have her have nothing on, or almost nothing on at least, they just took the cast off and were obviously very careful. I've never had a broken bone before. I've certainly never worn a cast. But that proves yet again how tough she was, that she could do that kind of deal. We covered her in Psycho, which is 2 years after this movie, and then she was 2 years later in The Manchurian Candidate, another great film where she actually, spoiler alert, but we covered that so long ago, is probably one of the villains. And of course, she's Jamie Lee Curtis's mama and Tony Curtis's ex-wife. Lee's agent said no at first when the project came across, I assume, his desk, but then Lee found out Wells was directing and she was in. Reminds me of how James Woods found out he was supposed to have been cast in Reservoir Dogs had the agent given him the damn script. He probably was going to be Mr. Orange, people seem to think. And when Woods found out, he fired his agent.
Wow.
Marlena Dietrich is Tana, who has got a pretty big role in a supporting part. She started in the silent era and was still working into the late 50s. One of her big movies is Morocco. She's also really good the year before this movie in Witness for the Prosecution. She's got a great opening line. We're closed. Like the house, an opening line for her. Not in the beginning of the movie, but her first line. And her last line is, what does it matter what you say about people? Or her very last line is, adios. But she says that other line. What does it matter what you say about people?
He was some kind off. Of a man. Mm-hmm. I love that.
So last Didn't, speech,
Weren't you very fond of him? He was some kind of a man. To be that generic about somebody who just died, it's a cruel thing to say, but you do get the impression that she had some affection for him.
She definitely did. Yeah, there's a history there, too. She was only on set for a day or two or something like that, too. They just burned through her footage It looks like she's on set for lots of days. She's got 4 or 5 different scenes.
She leaves a huge impression. Mm. One thing that's really not explained in the film is what she was doing by the river at the end. How did she end up there?
She had to be, or else there'd be no ending.
Well, no one else can say this line with as much panache as she can, so hey, she's just there.
Even though Mort Mills as Schwartz is very subtle in the film, he's the one that she's talking to. He's not one of the ultimate main characters. Of course, it's our three big stars, or even Grandy or Menzies. They're either dead, or they've left. So it's Vargas, and Susie have driven off, but the other three guys are dead. So now we're left with just Schwartz and Tana, and they have the last exchange, which is so famous in this film.
There are so many characters in this movie, part of the reason probably why it's confusing. But I think that's part of Welles' style. At this point in his career, he definitely informed his style on Shakespeare. He was a student of Shakespeare. How many Shakespeare films did he make?
I think 5 or 6.
Yeah, so clearly that was his go-to. You can see parallels in Touch of Evil, where he has a large cast, but also there's just such a rich tapestry of characters. They're archetypes, but they're very well drawn. And then, of course, the language is unparalleled.
So Mort Mills, I just mentioned, is Schwartz. He's a sunglasses-wearing cop in Psycho who Janet Leigh thinks is on her tail when she's first stolen the money before she even meets Norman Bates. But he's very good in a role that people don't really talk about from this film. Mercedes McCambridge, who is the voice of Pazuzu in The Exorcist, is the one who says, "I want to watch." And she was coming off about 9 years before an Oscar for All the King's Men as supporting actress. But she's got a tiny role in this movie.
But also this kind of strange and radical detail is that she appears to be transgender. She appears to be a he. She's dressed like a man. She kind of talks like a man. Again, has to be very intentional.
Why would a woman be interested in seeing some other woman, even if she's happy this is happening and Vargas would get screwed over and Susie would get screwed over? But still, why do you want to watch a woman get raped?
Well, she's also a gringo. I'm sure she has no love for this woman, doesn't care what happens to her.
Do you think the movie's racist?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm judging it by the standards of a movie made in 1958. Racist because they cast a white man to play a Mexican, period.
But then some of the Mexican characters are rapists using drugs, not bringing drugs, as some Make America Great people would say.
What do you think?
It's one of those things you have to take a look at the times when it was made. And the real bad guy is a white guy who doesn't even respect. It's not cool he doesn't respect the Mexicans, but it's not like he's in bed with them, so to speak. He's against them. Although he's using them, then he is in bed with them, isn't he? He uses Grandy and Grandy's gang.
Who he ultimately murders.
But he's probably used him before. Grandy seems like he's a big-time criminal down there. Vargas has been investigating Grandy, so Grandy's guilty of other things beyond anything we see in the actual movie.
It's a very nuanced film with a lot of nuanced characters. It didn't really set off that many alarm bells with me outside of Charlton Heston being cast as a Mexican. There's bad guys in America, there's bad guys in Mexico. The bad guys in Mexico are clearly gangsters. The bad guy in America, Quinlan, he's an authority.
And so is his partner, Menzies, so they both are dead, and they've done a lot of bad things.
So I think that says something right there. In Mexico, the bad guys are criminals. In America, the bad guys are the administration. They're the bureaucracy. They're running the place.
You know what's kind of scary is that whoever takes over from Quinlan and Menzies will probably do the same things to the Mexicans, if not worse.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's what happens in every single city, and particularly in places that have a vulnerable population, like a border town.
Yeah, I think in the book it was not a border town, but Welles specifically wanted that to be a big plot point. So Joseph Calleja is Menzies. He worked for 30-plus years, was in Algiers and The Alamo, the John Wayne movie, a couple of years after this film. And then Joseph Cotten, who we talked about a lot, of course, last week, because he was one of the stars of Shadow of a Doubt. He was also in our Citizen Kane re-release not that long ago, and here he's got a very small role, almost not in the movie at all. But Ray Collins, who is Boss Jim Geddes in Citizen Kane, has a pretty big role as a DA in this picture. So they're both Welles veterans, and they're both fine in their roles, especially Collins, because he has a lot more to do than Cotten does. Writer and director Orson Welles, who of course made Citizen Kane, and I've mentioned this movie before, Chimes at Midnight. If you haven't seen it, I think it's still on YouTube for free. Check it out if it is. Effectively, at this point, he was an indie filmmaker, which is so strange to think that this guy should have been ruling Hollywood. But speaking of ruling Hollywood, we've had a run of great directors. We covered Bergman, the Coens, Marty Scorsese, Hitchcock, and now 2 in the last little while because of our Citizen Kane re-release by Orson Welles. We won't be covering as many great directors, or at least famous and classic directors, but that is a great run that we didn't intend to have quite that way. And some black and white movies again the last couple weeks. He used very long takes. We talked about the ceiling shots, bringing those back from Citizen Kane, shadows, dark faces. What a technical masterpiece this was of black and white filmmaking. Franklin Cohen and Paul Monash did uncredited work on the screenplay. Monash was a producer on Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid and Carrie. And as I said, they loosely based it on Whit Masterson's 1956 novel, Badge of Evil. Welles did not like the title Touch of Evil at first. He grew to like it. I prefer Badge of Evil. I think it should have been Badge of Evil.
I like touch of evil, though, because it's the implication that you have a good person that just has a touch of evil. Not a touch of corruption, a touch of evil, because his behavior, his actions are evil, and even if they kind of started in a good place.
And almost everything he's ever done that's evil is many years before. As we learn, he and Menzies have been doing a lot of bad things for a very long time. And you talked about Albert Zugsmith, the producer who had produced Written on the Wind and The Incredible Shrinking Man. This movie is 1:37:1, so another square-looking picture like Shadow of a Doubt was, even though this could have been widescreen, but it was not. We watched the DVD in black and white, and even though it wasn't the Blu-ray, it looked pretty solid. It was one of those prints that I don't remember if it was remastered. Maybe when Merch re-edited the movie, they actually did a pass on it and cleaned up all the crap.
But something we haven't given Merch credit for yet, the sound. They did another pass on the sound. One of the great things about the redo is that in the original version, I think they just had score. And it was Merch and his team that put together a truly incredible, rich soundtrack to
using
that
diegetic sound.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the movie is. Henry Mancini is the composer in the movie, and he's the guy who did the Breakfast at Tiffany's score, and also he's most famous for da-dum, da-dum, in the Pink Panther.
Yeah.
The guy won 4 Oscars in total in his career. But the music that he composed for this doesn't really matter. It is the diegetic sound. It's supposed to be, and we see this in the opening shot, or hear it, I should say, of music from the clubs and music from people's radios and stuff. In that opening shot, that's where it's coming from. The cinematographer was Russell Meddy, who won an Oscar 2 years later. A lot of 1960 movies we're covering here accidentally, not intentionally at all. But he won an Oscar for Spartacus, and I've heard that he really didn't shoot that movie. It was really more Stanley Kubrick shooting his own movie. But anyway, he got the Oscar that year. And also The Omega Man with Charlton Heston. And he worked for 40-ish years, so he worked a long time. Talked about the editors already, including Walter Murch doing the new version. Let's skip on down to the influence. Curtis Hansen says this movie inspired one of the greats, and we covered this last year, L.A. Confidential.
I can see that.
A lot of dirty cops in that. So I guess Wells' character becomes James Cromwell's character. The really dirty cop has been doing bad things for a very long time, with help in both cases. It's not just one guy doing it. One of the best scenes in Get Shorty, a movie that I think is very underrated, has Chili, John Travolta, watching Touch of Evil, knowing the dialogue, and loving it. And that's when Rene Russo, who watches him for a little while, she comes at the very end, falls in love with him, I think. Because she hears him mouthing the dialogue and she watches just how much of a kid he is watching this movie. Right down when it's over, he looks around like, yeah, is anyone else as into this as I am? He even touches a guy on the shoulder. Hey, yeah, you like that? Good, huh? So that was a really cool little moment in that movie. It's one of the best moments in Get Shorty, I think. It's also, Touch of Evil is one of those movies that has inspired entire books to be written about it. Just like Citizen Kane has had lots of books in Star Wars. And as we've been talking about, it resonates today. The murderous cops who set up people. More so with the Mexican-American relations. And as we record this podcast, the border wall is a big thing again. Now dumbass is talking about sending troops down to the border to guard it against things like what happened in this movie, I guess. So this movie is more of the moment than most classic movies we've ever covered are because of the border, Mexico, drugs, racism, dirty cops.
White people playing people of color.
That doesn't really happen so much anymore, at least. That's
just
what's
in
of the moment.
Exodus, Gods of Egypt. What's it called?
Gods and Kings.
Thank you.
It was such a great movie, babe. Get the title right. Everybody saw it. All right, the awards and lists section. The movie won the top prize at the 1958 Brussels World Fair, and Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut were guys who voted on the movie at that point. They were still film critics, but very soon after, they made their own films. And they were also independent-ish kind of filmmakers. I mean, they weren't independent in France, but they weren't given big budgets in America. Truffaut eventually made some films in America and became an actor in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Touch of Evil made the Sight and Sound list in 2012. It was 25th on the director's poll and 57th on the critic's poll. And it also made the National Film Registry in 1993, another great batch of movies. It Happened One Night, A Night at the Opera, Yankee Doodle Dandy, An American in Paris, Shane, come back, The Godfather Part II, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Blade Runner, and also movies we've covered that are not AFI films, because all of those were His Girl Friday and Sweet Smell of Success. Match me, Sydney. Which was only a year before this movie, and as I've said many times, one of my favorites of all time was Sweet Smell of Success.
And another great example of a movie that bombed when it first came out and kind of got buried, and then over the years gained in esteem.
Black and white, a lot of dirty people, almost everybody in that movie, other than another Susie, actually. Susan Harrison, the sister. Almost everybody else in the movie is a bad guy.
She's not perfect either in that movie. God, that's a great movie.
That's true, but she's more innocent than the two main characters. I guess the Vargas couple are innocent in this film. Vargas, Vargas, Vargas. Touch of Evil was 64th on the top 100 thrills, and Psycho, which we've talked about a lot in this podcast, was number one. Touch was nominated for the top 100 genres in the gangster category, the top 50 villains, obviously Quinlan, and the top 25 music scores, even though the music score is not something people think about. They think about that diegetic sound, or no music at all, really. You've hated so many of the music scores, but you couldn't have hated this one because there's not that much music in it.
It's true, I didn't hate it. I liked it. I just hate too much. People overkill it
and
way too much.
Telling you how to feel and that kind
yes.
of thing. Okay, let's wrap it up. Last thoughts on one of my favorites. I guess it's not one of yours, but Touch of Evil. Finish it now.
I liked it. It's been really fun to talk about. I've got to give it another shot. I've got to watch it again and just pay attention to it on a different level now that I've got my first viewing over with.
But I'm glad you liked most of the things that I did. So I think that says that one day you're going to probably say, pretty good stuff.
Even if I never come around to the movie in the same way, there's so much to admire and enjoy about the direction of each individual scene on its own.
And it certainly is a shame that Orson Welles wasn't more of a player in Hollywood for 20 or 30 years. One movie that he makes that bothers people and makes them mad in 1941, still one of the greatest of all time, if not the greatest of all time, and that ever since then he had to struggle against studios or not even work with studios and slugged along and still made a lot of really good films, including Chimes at Midnight, Touch of Evil, Citizen Kane, Magnificent Ambersons, people love that one, some other pretty good ones, but should have been more of a player than he was, like Hitchcock was in the studio system, making great one after great one and having support. But maybe that's what made a movie like this even better.
So innovative.
When we return next week, we'll talk about Charlize Theron tearing it up in Patty Jenkins' serial killer biopic, Monster. Yes, the same woman who directed Wonder Woman, and the only two movies so far she's ever directed. So different. One was a minor indie hit that did win an Oscar for Theron. The other one was one of the biggest hits last year, and I guess you could say of all time, in Wonder Woman. The coming attractions trivia for Monster. I couldn't think of anything better than this, so a rhetorical question, but give this some thought, you and the listeners. Is 2003 the greatest year ever for women filmmakers? And here's why. Lost in Translation by Sofia Coppola, Whale Rider by Nikki Caro, Sherry Springer Berman was a co-director on one of my favorites that year, American Splendor, and of course Monster was Patty Jenkins. Plus, In America and Return of the King were co-written by two women along with a male director, and Nancy Meyers's, even though I didn't like it, Something's Gotta Give, was a big hit. So find a better year for women filmmakers and some major titles than that. And I'd like to hear about it. Let's talk about it next week.
And we will. If you want to check that out, then tune in next week for our podcast about Monster. And if you crave more Ryan and Bev between now and then, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We've covered around 250 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisAllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. That's all one word, top100project, and it is not case sensitive.
You reminded me, I should have said this before now, that next week is the 250th podcast.
I knew it was close.
It'll be a Monster. So that's number 250. Now that's 250 podcasts, not 250 movies. But we'll get into that detail a little bit next week.
We'll get deep into top 100 stats with you.
Maybe not quite deep. But we'll discuss a little bit.
And cut.
Chum is a Mexican.